Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program James Marchand. He is an emeritus professor of languages of linguistics and German languages and literature, I get that right, at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while is here on the program, and we talk a little bit about the origins of words. That's one of his main interests. He knows a lot about how language changes over time, how the meaning of words can change, or the way that they're used can change, about how different people in different places use different words, sometimes to express the same sort of thought. And we've always had a good time when he is here, and he's been good enough to keep coming back. So we're here for your questions, your inquiries. If there's something that's sort of on your mind that's word-related, you're welcome to call. And he will take a shot at seeing if he can answer your question. Of course, we can't promise all questions can be answered. We need to maintain some mystery in life. But I know that he'll have something interesting to tell you. Here, the number to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for if you live around Illinois or Indiana or any place the signal will travel, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, it's good to have you here. It's been quite a while, I think.
Yeah, it has been. It's good to be back.
I've been thinking about Latin a little bit recently. Maybe it's because I have to confess, recently I watched the movie Gladiator, and it started me thinking, I guess, about Caesar, the word, the term. What's the derivation of Caesar? What actually does that mean?
Well, actually, it's from his his family name, and if you ask for the etymology of it, it probably means something like hammer, or a person that hits, or whatever, much like Stalin or Eisenhower. Well, I might say Eisenhower is a good translation of it, so to speak, because Eisenhower means iron chopper.
Like a blacksmith?
Yeah, a blacksmith, sure. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that the Caesars were not blacksmiths, but then we took the name from the Caesars and made it into the name, like Tsar in Russian comes from Caesar.
Kaiser.
And Kaiser in German, and so on and so forth. And even in Gothic, which is my main language, it's Kaisar is the word for Caesar. So it got to be used after that all over the place by kind of like we say any kind of thing like Kodak for camera. And so it's a common thing that happens with such names.
So it started out being a family name, but then it became a title, and then because all the Caesars obviously weren't all related to one another. Well, no. maybe a lot of them were distantly related to one another.
And after that, it got to be used everywhere. That is, Kaiser Wilhelm and Kaiser Karl and all those marvelous people. And a lot of people don't realize, but if you start thinking about it, you can see why the Russian word Tsar is from Kaiser. And a lot of times, K's become Ts in all kinds of languages, like all of Latin K's, which were spelled C's, became Ts in French. Well, I shouldn't say all, because some of them became Sh, but grosso modo, all of them became Ts, and so that Kentum becomes San.
How common is it? It must be, when you start thinking, it must be fairly common that people's names do, one way or another, have something to do with occupations, and the people were named for, a lot of people at least, were named for what it was that they did.
Yeah. My name, for example, originally meant peddler. Marché means to walk, and then marché means to sell, and so it became seller, and brought us together with the Kennedys. Canna in Irish means to sell, to purvey. And so this sort of thing is, as you say, extremely common. We sometimes lose those connections, and no reason why we shouldn't. So people called Cooper don't realize that they were originally barrel makers. Mm-hmm. And so when you start thinking about just almost any name, and then when it moves from one language to the other, you lose, like, Eisenhower, who would know what that meant? And Stalin, the man of steel, and which was not his original name, of course, he took that one. So there are all kinds of strange things like that happen in languages.
Uh-huh. All right. Looks like we're getting a couple callers here lined up. If people have questions about words and language, this is the guy to talk to. James Marchand is our guest. He's emeritus professor of linguistics and Germanic languages and literature at the University of Illinois. Every once in a while he's here, and we have these conversations about words. And if you have questions, you're welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller is on the campus. This is line number one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
I think maybe we're having a problem with the caller here.
Hello?
Oh, I think we got, how about, can you hear us now?
Hello? Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay. The question was about the word, the name Eisenhower. I'm wondering if the thing comes from the mining industry rather than the iron smith, because in the mining districts of Germany, the word Hauer is used for one of the higher ranked miners, Kohlenhauer or Eisenhauer, rather than from a person who beats the iron, meaning the iron smith.
Yeah, I think you're probably right that it means an iron chopper or a coal chopper or a Kupferhauer or whatever, whoever howls what.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, whatever the meaning comes out of that, once you get the word, then it gets to mean most anything that anyone wants to have it mean. But I think you're probably right that originally it just meant somebody who howled.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, all right. Very good. Well, let the record show I was the guy who said blacksmith. It wasn't Professor Marshall. We'll go to another caller here. Hersher is next, line number four.
Hello?
Yes.
What I would be interested in, how did the Yiddish language come, where it came from, and how old it is? You know, because when you listen to Yiddish, there's so much German in it. I mean, if they talk slower, so you could, as a German, you could understand it. And I wonder, how did that evolve, and how old is this language?
Yeah, if this were 50 years ago, I could answer straightforwardly. Nowadays, there are all kinds of different theories, some of them less palatable than others. Let me give you three of the theories. There is a theory which is pushed by YIVO and the Weinreichs and Max Weinreich, which says that Yiddish comes from some form of Romance, that is French, let's say. They make up a place called Lothar, and they make up a language called Loezic, and say that Yiddish comes from that. There are those who say Yiddish, like Paul Wechsel, for example, who believes that Yiddish comes from a relexification of Russian. I'd hate to try to explain that to you. I myself feel that Yiddish, there being, of course, two major dialects of Yiddish.
Yeah, it's like
Eastern Yiddish and Western Yiddish. So Eastern Yiddish, I think, just comes from German. You know, the Jews were driven out in 1349 because of the Black Death. They were accused of poisoning the wells and so forth. And they went east. And in the east, of course, they went just like the German dialects in the same area and so forth, and they took on particular characteristics. There being three major dialects of Eastern Yiddish. Western Yiddish has died out. It was killed off in part by the Enlightenment. I'm getting off too far, I guess, off on things. But anyway, Western Yiddish, things like the Bovo Buch and things like that, came about. The first book in Western Yiddish published is from 1507. And so Yiddish is really, I think, much based on German. You'll notice that there are, you can say whole sentences in Yiddish using only Polish. There's a famous story, a kaczka med noin polka, a duck with only one flipper. And kaczka is the Polish word for duck, and polka is the Polish word for flipper, whatever a duck has. Mm-hmm. And so you have a lot of things you can say with, and you can probably, if you worked hard, say something with only Hebrew in it. So that Yiddish is a mixture of German mainly with an admixture of Slavic or whatever areas they were in, and even Lithuanian and Lithuanian. For example, Lithuanian Yiddish, if you're a Litvak, you only have two genders. So things are different. And then with Hebrew, of course. And the Hebrew will depend on, you know, how much you put in. And the strange thing is now you have a problem that since you have Ivrit, which puts the accent on the last syllable, sometimes the Hebrew component gets messed up. So it's a complicated business.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me it always sounded like a, or sounds like a dialect, you know, a German dialect.
Well, if you work hard and you are, have a good ear, you can speak. How I learned Yiddish was speaking German with my Yiddish friends, because at first I didn't know. I'm like you. I thought it was just another dialect. So,
but it isn't.
I would say Guten Tag. They would say Agitug.
Yeah.
And so there would go.
So it isn't really a German dialect.
Well, no, I wouldn't say it's a German dialect, but I think it's a language that came from German.
Yeah. And what's Meshuggah?
Meshuggah just means, that's a Hebrew word, just
I
means
know.
Crazy.
In the Rhineland, my mother came from, she always had Meshuggah. And then when I came here to United States, I had Meshuggah. I said, oh, that's what my mother, wasn't Jewish. In the Rhineland, they said always Meshuggah.
Well, the judge in the Gary Davis trial said, these are mentions Meshuggah.
Yeah.
And so you can say Meshuggah if you want to. We always said when we're poking fun at our Michigan friends, Michigan is a real Michigas. Michigas means craziness.
I just was so surprised that it was a Yiddish word, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. Bye. Let's continue. We have a caller in Bloomington. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
7 years ago, I had an oncologist who was from Czechoslovakia. His name was D-V-O-R-A-K, and I called him Dr. Dvorak. Most people there at the hospital called him Dvorak. And one day I asked him if he was related to the composer's family. And he said, no, that's a common name in Czechoslovakia. Now, do you know what that means?
No, I don't know any Czech at all, but I wouldn't be surprised by what it had something to do with herding animals or something like that. The Ak means ER. It's a agent, and it's Dvorak is his name, because that R has a hachik, as we call it, above it.
Uh-huh.
Has a little V above the R, and it's pronounced zh.
Uh-huh.
And but it's like Russian Vier means an animal. And it probably means a herdsman or something like that, but I'm not sure. I don't know any Czech at all. I can say things like "Eisenbahnjak pustí mašín," the railroad worker polishes the machine, and things like that. And I can also say "stick your finger through your throat," which has nothing but rrrs in it, no vowels, things like that. But I'm not very good at Czech. I can read it.
Well, I always called him Dvorak. That's because of the composer.
Yeah, well, you have to do what you can.
And he didn't object to it in the slightest, but everyone else there called him Dvorak. So.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Doctor.
All right. Other questions are welcome. Our guest is James Marchand. He's Emeritus Professor, Linguistics and Germanic Languages and Literature at University of Illinois, and here occasionally is with us on the program. We talk a little bit about the origins of words and languages and how they change over time. And if you have questions, you are welcome to call the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that. That's 800-222-9455. Again, it's 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I don't know. I expect probably I've asked you this question before. Linguists, one of the things that linguists are interested in, or some linguists are interested in, is whether they could puzzle out what the earliest languages might have been And we can go from where we are now. We can go back on a number of steps. We know about Latin and Greek and the languages of the ancient Near and Middle East and all that sort of stuff. But some linguists have thought about, well, can you look at the languages that we know about and can you draw any sorts of theories about where those languages came from? For example, they say, "What could we point at a word or words and say, we think these are the oldest words that we have?" Has there been anything particularly new on this topic of the original language or languages?
Oh, it's been a great deal new. There are people who are into what those of us who sneer at it call it the proto-world movement. Mm-hmm. But there are people who are trying to get back past Indo-European. Indo-European is the proto-language. Like, if you take English and German and Swedish and Norwegian and Yiddish, you can reconstruct the thing we call proto-Germanic. If you take that and Latin and Greek and Sanskrit and so forth and put them together, you can come up with proto-Indo-European and have a fair idea. There are even examples like Schleicher wrote a fable in Indo-European. Now there are those who try to go back beyond that with Japhetic hypotheses and all kinds of things, and I think you probably can't do that very well. That is, you can do it if you want to, and it's an enjoyable sort of thing. There are also arguments about what the culture was like of the, let's say, the Indo-Europeans, and we have people who will say, well, I can reconstruct a word for fish, therefore they must have had fish. I can reconstruct, you know, and there's a great deal of that sort of thing going on. You'll end up with things like you can reconstruct a word for cow but no milk, or a word for milk and no cow, if you however you work those things. So you have a lot of problems there, and there are a great number of people trying to figure out exactly where they lived. And most people figure the steppes of southern Russia and so on would be a good place to put them, because if they were there and they spread out everywhere. But people don't always start in the center and spread out, maybe, you know. But we do have all kinds of interesting theories going on, and people who try to construct proto-world and call it different kinds of things. And so,
but it sounds as if it were in the realm that's so theoretical that one person's idea might be as good as another person's idea, given how well they can support the argument.
Yeah, and I think that's what it is. That is, by ordinary linguistic means, you can't do that. But it's something like the Pan-Celtic people and so forth. You get started with something like that and you really like it, and you can get your book published and a lot of people read it, and it's great to be on internet with, and you know. So there is a tremendous amount of work going on in that field, and a lot of people, you know, trying to prove that the word for sweet potato is the same in Africa and the South Pacific and South America, which shows a kind of a proto-sweet potato thing, you know.
Okay. We have another caller here, somebody calling from over at Parkland College, so we'll talk with them on line one.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi, I have a question about names. My mother's maiden name is Tewel, but it's spelled like jewel, only with a T, T-E-W-E-L, and we've never been able to figure out really what that means or the origin. We thought it might be British, meaning two wells, because T-E-W, I think, used to be the spelling for two, T-O-W. But I just wanted to get some ideas from you.
Well, I'm afraid I can't help you. The name, by the way, is frequently spelled T-U-E-L-L. I used to work at a dairy, and the name of it was Tewel's Dairy.
Yes, it's a very unusual spelling. You hardly ever see it spelled T-E-W-E-L.
And I wouldn't know what particular, you don't happen to know what, whether you all are from Sweden or where?
We think it might be either British or Scottish, somewhat in that area.
Uh-huh. Well, what I would do would be try to move my family back as far as I could, and see if I could find out where we came from. And then, because Tule, of course, is not an uncommon name. I know, by the way, that Mr. Tule that I knew was of Swedish origin.
Mm-hmm.
But that wouldn't help me, because the only thing I can think about is Tule, which is a Swedish word for toll, which wouldn't do much. You'd have to be a toll taker or something like that, like Matthew was.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, well, other questions are certainly welcome. Questions about language, questions about words, that's what we do here when Professor Marjand is with us. Your questions are certainly welcome. The number, again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and a toll-free 800-222-9455. We were talking about names a little bit, and I just raised the issue of how many people have names that one way or another had to do with what their perhaps an ancestor did, what their occupation was. How common is it also that people get named for the place where they lived?
Well, that's very common. A lot of times they don't get named for it. I mean, originally they just left it, and that was the only name they could think of. And it's funny that towns will get named for some town in the other country, and you'll say, well, all the people there must have come from, let's say, well, there's a town next to Lewisburg where I come from named Belfast. So one might say, well, they come from Belfast, and so, but they don't. They just, that sounded like a good name to them and so on. And the same thing happens with people, and it was very common in the Middle Ages, if you could get it done, to name yourself from the place you were from, once we have the particle in German, von, and which shows that you were a nobleman, because only noble people could name themselves like von Eschenbach, although he claims not to be that noble. Then, of course, you had other names, like when Jews were forcibly given names, that is, in the Middle Ages, a Jew would take the name not of a living grandfather, but some previous person and so on and so forth. So he would have his name, like we do also with in Iceland and Russia and a number of places where your name would be John, son of John. Mm-hmm. And there you'd have John. And so you have words like Isaacson and so on. Well, since the Jews did not have good, honest, straightforward names like Napoleon needed to put them down in his book, they would give names to Jews, and of course they would sell them to them. And sometimes you didn't have any money, you didn't get a very good name. Your name would be Schaberstunk or something like that. And so we have lists of these names that the people had. And so that's why we have these marvelous names with names of flowers and so on, so like Blumenthal and so on and so forth. Names are really a problem. They were a problem among the Romans, and people liked to give names that made sense. So they would have nomen est omen, they would say, and we're called the this and that because they make sense. And of course, people have always sold names like we do nowadays. So you can go down and say, I want to change my name, and pay enough money and get your name changed. Names are a real problem, and you can never tell what's going to happen to them because, for one thing, they get mispronounced. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take very long to get the name totally mispronounced, so you can't anymore. Sometimes if you're going back through names, tell. For example, the name Tool we were talking about, that might have had two or three things. Like if you take Jimmy Connor's name, that goes back to Conichover. And so Conover and Connor are the same name usually. But you have no way of knowing what syllables they will drop out when.
Mm-hmm. Did that change? Was that just about people making the name easier to write?
No, I think it's being sloppy. Like if you start looking at a name like Sullivan in Irish, and you see how it's spelled Sullivan, you don't realize that, or Sullivan. And then you have problems with other people moving in, like in Ireland, somebody would be called Mac this and Mac that, and when the French moved in because the English were settling them there, they would change Mac to Fitz. And so you have Fitzwilliam, Mac Williams, same meaning.
Hmm. Okay. Let's talk with somebody else here. We get to caller in Champagne, line number one, right here. Hello.
Yeah, I was just going to continue on this name thing, on the issue of what I would call the Ellis Island effect. And I have a couple, the person with the name Tool might have been a sufferer, as it were, of that. An old friend of our family's last name is Bunker, but she's French. Her original name was Verboncourt, which means from the good heart. But when her family moved to America, they changed it to Bunker, which, I mean, what does that mean? I don't know. It could be a lot of things. My own last name is Dutch, and according to some Dutch people I met, it's spelled wrong, in the sense that the people in Holland spell it differently than the people here do. And I, in fact, changed the spelling of my last name even more because it had a hyphen and a space, and computers would mangle that. They're better about it now, but they back when I really needed it several years ago, I had a bunch of problems with records getting lost and things like that due to databases not being written properly. But there's a couple other examples you can think of, but actually, if you saw the movie The Godfather 2, where Vito, whatever his name was, Andolini, I think, shows up in New York at immigration, and they just write down Corleone. So it's really hard
to say
a lot of last names.
Yeah, well, exactly that thing happened. People came here, and some American immigration official decided, oh, this name is too complicated, and either they gave him a new one or they changed the spelling or maybe they chopped part of it off. They did lots of those sorts of things.
Yeah, they sure did. So the Ellis Island effect is kind of like the Fortran effect. You were mentioning computers. In Fortran, you can only have 8 characters the first side of your card, and so a lot of people had to chop their names off, and I guess some of them said, hey, that doesn't sound bad, or maybe the computer messed them up. But that happens with names and everything else.
Oh, sure. Well, my late, one more and I'll hang up. My late grandfather, or step-grandfather, I guess, but whatever, his family name was Jacobs with an S, and for some reason he just decided he didn't like the S. When he was in about third or fourth grade or something, he started writing his name as Jacob. His parents didn't read very well and never noticed. And so the rest of his family goes by Jacobs, and he went by Jacob.
Yeah, that's not uncommon either, that someone in the family decides. I have a friend who's from Sweden, and he doesn't like Americans at all, but his father did. And so his last name is Jansson, but he has to spell it Johnson because his father changed it to that.
Oh, no.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go on to somebody else here, right here in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. I don't remember where I heard this, but it could have been when I visited Ellis Island several years ago or the Tenement Museum. But apparently this so-called Ellis Island effect actually didn't happen very often. I think probably what was more common was that that spellings weren't solidified. You find different family groups spelling the name differently. People were often not very literate, and those kinds of factors caused changes in names. But also, people just often wanted names that sounded more the way they perceived to be as American names.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And first names, especially people thought that we Americans put Y's on everything, so people like to call their kids Mikey. I mean, as a name, not as a nickname. And so you'll have that sort of thing also. Happens all over the place.
And also there was a lot of particular group sentiment. For instance, anti-German sentiment at various times. And some people often change their names for that reason. Do you happen to know what occupation Meyer is associated with, M-Y?
Farmer.
Farmer? Any particular kind of farmer? Someone told me it was associated with dairy.
No, of course, could be associated with dairy, I think, but people are thinking Meyerie and things like that and so on. But Meyer is just a farmer. Now, it could be a dairy farmer because you see a lot of Meyers. And a Meyerei would be a dairy farm, But Meyer is not particularly associated with dairy farming. Mm. You can have I happen to know of a place where there's a bunch of Meyers up in the hills, and that could be, I suppose, connected with milking goats or something. I don't know.
I also thought that I understood that the use of middle names in this country was essentially introduced by the influx of Germans, that it was common in Germany to have middle names, but it wasn't common to see them among groups who preceded the large influx of Germans to this country.
Well, there's a big argument about why do Americans insist on middle names and middle initials. Some of them have middle initials that have no middle names. And it's kind of hard to know what happened there. It's very common also in countries to have a first initial and a middle name and to have what we do. And many countries, if you write your name out, you just put down the, like in England, it's very common to just say J.W.B. Smith and things like that. So with giving, and so when you do bibliographies, as I'm doing right now, you have a hard time because most of the people want you to give the first name. And sometimes there is no way of finding the first name for your bibliography. Do the best you can.
Okay.
Thanks.
Very good. Again, we have time here for other questions. If you'd like to call and talk with our guest, James Marchand, he's Emeritus Professor of Linguistics and German Languages and Literature, and occasionally he is here on the show. We talk a little bit about words and where they come from and how they change over time. We have maybe about 17 or 18 minutes left in this part of the show and time for other calls. So if you have a question, you can call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Back to the matter of the first language or earliest languages, have some people nominated, for as far as we know, what they would think would be some of the earliest words that perhaps are still in common use? Maybe they have changed over time, different languages have taken them, and that pronunciation perhaps has changed. But a word that we can say, these are among some of the oldest words. We're sure that these are really, really old words.
Well, people have done this. I'm not sure that there's any agreement on any of those things, but certainly that people have tried to go back to the oldest words, and some of them say they were grunts, and so you have Sturtevant who says language came about when people began to lie. And so you rub your stomach and say, so the guy won't hit you and point that there's food down the line. And so became, I'm lying. And so there's been a great deal of that. It's interesting that it's come back. There have been rules laid down, for example, at the French Academy that you couldn't talk about the origin of language. And I remember that the origin of Indo-European and Semitic, there was a time when the Linguistic Society of America declared that that subject could not be discussed again. And
why? Because it was contentious?
No, because there were no facts involved.
Oh, I see.
And it was mostly, I think contentious. That is, some of us assumed that you could only work with cognates. So that, for example, it was all right to say that English dapper is cognate with German tapfer, which means brave, and that's cognate with Russian dobry, which means good. And so even though the meanings had changed so much, we figured that was all right. But when you got beyond that and tried to say that an Indo-European word and a Semitic word were connected, people felt like that wasn't a good thing to do. And the person who mentioned that there's a great deal of anti-this and anti-that, a great deal of groupism in the world, that same thing is true of things like linguistics. Mm-hmm. And so, and giving names. So if the particular person that was giving the name in Ellis Island was anti-Semitic, he's likely to do most anything. If he was anti-German, he's likely to do most anything. If he was anti-French, likely to do most anything. And so Irish names, since a lot of people are anti-Irish, just got messed up in every way.
Yeah.
And as did the Irish people when they were coming in. So there's a lot of prejudice in the world, and you have to expect that.
Yeah. Well, and I guess maybe what I took the call to be suggesting, maybe I'm reading something into this also, is that people, German people coming to the United States, they might catch on to the fact that maybe there was anti-German sentiment in America. So then what they would want to do is do what they could to make themselves appear less German and more American. So maybe then they might, that might not be the kind of thing that you do on the first day, but after a while you might start thinking, maybe it would be better if we changed our name in this way, because then this would sound more American, as if maybe we either didn't come from Germany or that we had been here in the United States for longer than we had.
Yeah, sometimes people would make mistakes. For example, my name is a very common crypto name in France, so that Jews that moved in were named Kaufmann would change their name to Marchand. This wasn't a good move on their part, but they didn't know. And so I think that self-censorship is the strongest kind of censorship. When you sit and say, well, you know, people don't like us Frenchmen or us Germans or whatever, and so let's change so that we don't seem so French and so German. The same way that assimilation took place. I think maybe, in fact, that assimilation took place much faster, let's say, in 1930 than it does nowadays. So,
other callers. Next is Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I don't want to beat this to death, but let me go back to at least one Jewish name, and that's Cohn, my name. But before I get to that, there was a rabbi here in Chicago who wrote a book, did a study of Jewish names, and came to the conclusion that most Jewish names were derived from four different roots, trees and cities, and I forget what the other, that is, plants and cities, and I don't remember what the others were. But in any case, as far as Cohn goes...
That's a nice name.
Pardon?
Cohn's a nice name.
Yeah.
Kohen Gadol.
Yeah, the high priest.
Yeah.
Well, Kohen is the Hebrew meaning priest, and this was the original root. I wonder how that ties in with the Irish name Kohen, or Kohen, if at all. But in any case, in Europe, our family was known as Kagan. At least that's the, or Kagan, which is the way my father pronounced it. And I asked him how it was changed to how it became Cohn, and he could never give an explanation except that it was on Ellis Island. And but in recent years, I got hold of what's called what they used to call a shift cartel, the paper that was used on the ship that provided transportation from Europe to New York or Hoboken. And it was written in Cyrillic, and the name there was in Cyrillic, and it looked like Cohn, except that I knew that G and H looked pretty much the same. The G or the H of the Russian or the Cyrillic looked similar to the G or the H here, and that's apparently how it became Cohn. Well, my father used this name, and when his brother came across about back in 22, that was about 17 years later, he assumed the name of Cohn since the rest of the family was named that. But about 15 years later, he changed it back to Kagan. And my father's half-brother went to Palestine in 37, and he changed it, his name, to Ben Tzvi. Well, Tzvi was his father's name. Americanized, it was Harry, but Tzvi was a Hebrew or Yiddish name, and now this uncle and his family are called Ben Tzvi. So will be.
Yeah, that's what happens a lot of times. Like, somebody will be named Velvel, and he'll change his name to Zev because that's the Hebrew word for wolf, or for little wolf. And so you get all kinds of things like that going on with names, and that's what you have to expect. People like to change their names. Sometimes it makes it very hard to trace them back if people sometimes call me up and ask me to help them trace their names back, and sometimes it can be quite difficult because of things like that. But if somebody's named Cone, that's a nice name, and Levi, that's another nice name. So
that's all out of the Bible, both of them. It's three different branches of...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go back here to local callers. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm someone who... my grandfather claimed to be Dutch. However, I think that's pretty much Pennsylvania Dutch and therefore very Germanic. But I have a feeling our family name was changed either during, you know, one of the times of anti-German sentiment, and the name my family currently goes by is Grove, as in a bunch of trees. And it's interesting because my father would like to believe that it was originally Graf, which I believe is some noble. And then I've thought of maybe Croft, which would be worker. But I was also wondering, would a name like Gruber have stuck out so highly that they would have just shifted the consonant from a B to a V? And so maybe Gruber would become Grove, you know, by dropping the R. Because I've been wondering that about the derivation of the Germanic name Grove. You know, and I was curious as to what ideas you might have on that.
Well, of course, it's according to what happens to the name from Germany coming over. That is, like, it could be most anything in German. It'd be nice to have it be Graf, which means duke or something like that, or count, I guess, would be the word. I don't keep up with those things. But Graf means count.
Okay.
Be bad to have it be Grob, which means coarse. It could come from Gruber, or it could come from, like you say, Gruber, or any of those. What happens, you cannot tell how they're likely to change the name. What you need to do is do like the previous caller and go back and look at the ship.
Research, right.
Yeah.
So one of the derivations may have been coarse?
Oh, I was only kidding. But the German word grob, G-R-O-B, means coarse.
Well, that would make sense then, because that would be someone just self-censoring.
Oh, because could
maybe they want to
could be,
name.
but the name Grove, of course, is a very common English name.
Right. However, it comes more from a German side, and yeah. One of my friends is in a similar position because his last name is Foster, and he knew a lot of Germans when he was growing up, and they said that it may have been Forster.
Uh-huh. I wouldn't be surprised.
And the other thing, and this is just a side point, I don't know if I'm right, but I believe that Gaius Caesar's family name was Julius.
I couldn't think of what you call those things. You're certainly right.
Yeah,
there is a nomen, cognomen, et cetera. I should have gone through all of that.
Well, and that's okay. I just don't know if Caesar was a title.
It became a title because of him.
Yeah.
And Augustus and so on.
Right, because I guess Octavius, at least in the book I read, everybody was just numbered.
Yeah.
In the family. I guess the person we call Caesar was kind of rare because he was called Gaius. And therefore Octavius was just the eighth... Of the Julian family, which is kind of interesting that they called them by numbers instead of what we would view as proper names. So, all right, well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, I should point out that in Roman law, sine nomine persona non est, you had to have a name for Roman law because you would not be a person before the court without a name. So that's why slaves had no names and why when you manumitted them, you would give them a name.
We have a couple of other callers here. We'll see if we can get them both. Homewood is the next person here. Line three. Hello.
Yeah, hello. This is a little bit off the name stuff, but we use in the colloquial language now, used to be for was. Where did used to get into our language as a verb or whatever you want to call it?
Well, it's been there for a long time.
It has.
Used was, even in Shakespeare's day, it was the custom of it to be. Used meant it was a use, it was a custom.
Oh.
And then we got to where, you know, we're so sloppy nowadays, we began to say used to.
Yeah.
And so used to is kind of a word you almost hate to see it spelled used to. But even in, as I say, even in earlier times, back as far as Elizabethan times, people would say used to mean was the custom.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
All right. Very good. Piatone is next here. Line number four. Hello.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
My name is from the south of France, from Languedoc, and mm-hmm. it's spelled I-S-S-E-R-T. And I, since there was so much religious war in there, I was wondering, in French that's pronounced Isère, could it have come from the north, from German, from the North Germanic, the Frankish area, as they were, you know, pushed to, as they would replace the people that were either killed or whatever, moved out of that southern part of France?
Well, I wouldn't be. I'm just looking for an etymology of it, and I can't come up with one offhand. But certainly the names in Languedoc, you would expect the possibility of the name being French, Provençal, even maybe
Basque.
Right. And it has a kind of a Basque sort of sound, but I don't know. I don't know any Basque at all. Maybe I could say 10 words of Basque.
One of my cousins in Montpellier said that he saw the name on German television, spelled I-S-S-E-R-T-M-A-N or M-A-N-N, Isert Man or Isert Man, uh-huh. on German television. So it seems to me that it could have a more Germanic or Frankish name.
Well, it certainly could be. I can't make out any kind of Germanic origin for it right at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what Isertmann in German would be. Mm-hmm. But that's a problem with such names. But anyway, you could write me if you want to. I could give you my email and I could look it up.
Okay.
Okay, my email is Marchand,
mm-hmm.
M-A-R-C-H-A-N-D,
mm-hmm.
at staff.
At?
Staff, S-T-A-F-F.
Oh, staff, okay.
Dot U-I-U-C, that's University of Illinois, E-D-U.
E-D-U, yeah.
And just send me a note, and I'll see if I can't find that.
Okay,
it kind of rings a sort of bell, but not much of one.
All right, we've had difficulty trying to find something about it.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. And we're going to have to stop there because the time has come to the end of the time. But I'm sure on another day, Professor Marchand will come back and we can talk some more. For the moment, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Our guest, James Marchand, is Emeritus Professor of Linguistics and Germanic Languages and Literature at the University of Illinois.